You're dead to sin. A Christian cannot be a servant of sin and live in the new life that he has espoused whenever he obeyed the gospel, and that has been demonstrated when he was raised from the watery grave of baptism. Then in chapter 6, again, he says, verse 15, What then shall we sin because we are not under law? Well, because he had said in verse 14, you are not under law but under grace. That is, not seeking justification on the basis of law. And so, well, if you're not under law but under grace, maybe that opens the door for sin, an opportunity to just sin. And in the latter part of this chapter, he's again showed how ridiculous that is. And in the first part of chapter 7, he deals with, again, continuing to deal with this issue of this question about not being under law, to show that you must be dead to law. And you've got to be dead to sin and have to be dead to law. And he illustrated it with the marriage law, God's marriage law, showing that as long as a person lives, he's in this case a married person, they're amenable to that law. The husband was bound by law to the as long as he lived, but then or the woman was bound by law as long as the husband lived. But if he died, then she was discharged from the law of the husband, showing again that death severs that bondage to law. Now, that was his illustration, again, to reinforce the statement and in answer to the question that was raised in chapter 6 and or the statement that was made in chapter 6, verse 14, and the question that was raised in verse 15, to show that you have to be dead to law. So dead to sin and dead to law. Now, if the wheels are turning in the same direction that raised those other two questions, then the next one would be, verse 7 of chapter 7, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? In other words, since being released from law is so good, and that must imply that the law is really bad. We've got to get away from that thing. It's just, you know, it's what's ruining us, would be kind of the thinking along that line. And so the question that comes up then is the law sin? And the same answer is given that he's given to the other two questions, and that is, God forbid. Absolutely not. So now, in the next five verses, he's going to answer directly that question, that is the law sin? And then, in the remaining part of the chapter, starting in about verse 14, my persuasion is he illustrates the answer that he gives in these five verses we're going to look at right now. So, let's first of all take a look at his answer. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would have not known sin except through the law, for I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. Now, what law is Paul using, putting himself in the picture here? What law is he using to answer the question? All right, the Ten Commandment law, the law of Moses. Now, what he says about the law of Moses is true about law, period. Principle applies. But what he's doing is showing to these people, and particularly since the Judaizing teachers were the ones that were causing all the problems, or causing a big part of the problems, then immediately bells would be going off in the minds of the people who have been hearing these Judaizing teachers who have been saying, you've got to keep the law of Moses. So, Paul has been charged with attacking the veracity and the integrity of the law, that is the law of Moses. And so this is one of his ways of showing again that that's not what he's saying about the law. And to me, this is one of the clearest death blows to Calvinistic doctrine of inherited depravity that you can put your finger on. Now remember, the Calvinist says that a person is born in sin, has inherited Adam's sin, and is guilty as a depraved sinner from the moment of birth. It would be somewhat amusing, I think, to hear a Calvinist try to explain how it is that if Paul was born in sin, how in the world could he say that he was alive apart from the law at some particular time, down in verse 9, or as he says that's the point that I wanted to make. Yeah, I was alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. Well, if he was a born sinner, he was dead from the get-go, spiritually speaking. But anyway, his point here is not to disprove Calvinistic doctrine, although it certainly does. But again, what he's illustrating, the fact that the law is good. And in this case, it was good because except he had heard the commandment, thou shalt not covet, he wouldn't have known that covetousness was wrong. The law defines sin. The last phrase of chapter 3, verse 20. For through the law comes the knowledge of sin. And of course, the reason for that is, by definition, sin is a transgression of law. 1 John 3, verse 4. So if that's what sin is, transgression of law, then the only way you're going to know what is sinful is to look at the law of God and see what it says. This is wrong. Thou shalt not covet. And all the other revelation that we have from God with regard to what's right and what's wrong. So, this obviously demonstrates that the law is good. Now, Paul personifies sin in the remainder of this chapter. In other words, sin is being described or discussed by Paul here as if it were a person. And I think it's reasonable if we want to substitute a person in this section as we read it, you could say Satan. Because this is exactly how Satan operates, using what God intended for good and positive results, Satan turns and uses it to produce bad results or evil results. And so he says, again, in explaining why we must be dead to law, is because sin or Satan, finding occasion, wrought in me through the commandment all manner of coveting, for apart from the law, sin is dead. Draw your attention to 1 Corinthians 15, verse 56. 1 Corinthians 15:56. The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. Satan, again, can take what is good, he can take the law of God, and he can use that as an opportunity or as an occasion to entice people to sin. He started that in the Garden of Eden. God gave Adam and Eve a law. Don't eat of the fruit of the tree that stands in the middle of the garden. In the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. That was for man's good. Satan took that law and he used that as an opportunity to entice Eve and Adam to sin. That's the way Satan operates. Again, the law is not the problem. It's the person succumbing to Satan's schemes and methods and devices. What is it the anti-gun advocates say? You know, guns kill. And then what's the pro-gun advocate's response to that? Guns don't kill, people kill. Yeah. The gun is benign, right? So, comparatively speaking, the law is benign in the sense that there's no evil in the law. People are the problem. People listening to Satan and yielding to Satan's advances. And that's the point again in Paul's answer to this question about, is the law sin? Is the law bad? Is there something wrong with the law? Absolutely not. God forbid. In fact, what happens is that Satan uses that as an occasion. He uses law as an occasion to get people to sin, and which then leads to death, because apart from the law, sin is dead. The power of sin is in the law. If you didn't have any law, no sin. So Satan would be powerless without law. Okay? Because there would be no law to break, so there couldn't be any sin. Then, and I was a little bit ahead of myself a moment ago, I was alive apart from the law once. But when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. Now, we know he couldn't be talking about the giving of this law initially. That was about 1,500 years before Paul was born. So in what sense could Paul be saying, you know, when the commandment came, is when I, in sin, revived and I died. When would that be as far as Paul's life is concerned?
He understood what sin, what the law was about, what sin was.
Okay.
Prior to that, he didn't.
So as a child, from the time he was born and up until some point, and there's no magic age of, you know, we talk about the age of accountability. It's just at the point where a person realizes now, here's God's law, here's what it says, and if I've violated it, I've transgressed it, then that makes me a sinner. That's when sin sprang to life, is the imagery here. It's like Paul was doing just fine, cruising along, Saul of Tarsus, and then all of a sudden sin just springs to life, revived. Because now he knows that he has broken God's law. But before that, he was alive. And that's why I say, Adamic sin and the doctrine of inherited depravity and all that, that can't be. I mean, this is not the only verse, of course, we can use to discuss that, and we have before. But no way in the world Paul could say he was alive if he was born as a dead sinner and then later on he died. Again, verse 11, for sin finding occasion through the commandment beguiled me and through it slew me. Satan. That's the way Satan operates. Just like he did Eve. He beguiled me. He deceived me. Using the occasion, the opportunity, this is his M.O. He's been doing that from the beginning, and that's the way he still operates. Stop right there for just a moment. Any questions about that or his illustration? Nancy? No. No, he's talking about when he was a child and he got up to the point then that now the Ten Commandment law, in this case, because he's quoted, thou shalt not covet. So that was the Ten Commandment law. So in Paul's life, it would have been whenever he got old enough to understand what it meant not to covet and that when you did that, you were violating God's law. So this would have as far as Paul's illustration here, would have nothing to do with the law of Christ. Right. Because, see, even chronologically, I mean, principle applies under law, period, but as far as Paul is concerned, chronologically, the law of Christ did not actually come into the world until he was an adult. Yeah. So he... Right. So, but that as far as he's concerned, personally, this is the point in his life when he realized what it meant to violate God's thou shalt not covet law. Any other question?
In dealing with that verse, I heard Joseph say that he said, if that's the case with verse 9, he said that it would be better to not teach people about the law of Christ. That way they wouldn't violate the law.
Yeah, and besides, he's already shown in chapter 1 and also in the first part of chapter 2 that all men are under law.
But the thing is that it shows how people try to manipulate the scriptures and be crazy
with it. Oh, yeah. Hey, in chapter 5 when he said that the law that sin reigned from Adam to Moses.
Yeah.
Round numbers, 6,000+ 7,000 years of time, in there. Maybe 6,000 or something like that. Yeah. Probably more like about 5,500, wasn't it? 5,500 to 6,000 years, something like that. Okay. Now, this raises another question in the mind of the person that's hearing Paul's argument. Verse 13. Has then what is good And this is the law, because remember, that's what he said, the law is good. Has then what is good become death to me? Certainly not. No. Sin, the law is not the problem. Okay. God forbid. But sin, that it might be shown to be sin, by working death to me through that which is good, and that's the law, that through the commandment sin might become exceeding sinful. By using what is good to accomplish a bad result, it just shows how bad sin or Satan is. And I think that's a kind of loose commentary on that verse there. Yeah. By using what is good to accomplish something as bad as death, it just underscores or shows how bad sin or Satan really is. Because he uses what is good to accomplish something so bad. So that's how bad or how evil or sin or Satan is. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. Yeah. Because there's nothing worse than being separated from God. Yeah. So, because sin or Satan personified, this is sin is personified here, using what is so good, the law, to accomplish what is so bad, separation from God, that just shows you how bad sin or Satan really is. You couldn't use any other terms to define how bad he is in any I don't guess more graphic way. Yeah. Right. But again, see, what Paul again is, he's still answering this question, is the law of sin? Is sin the problem? Is the fault to be laid at the feet of God in the sense because he gave the law? And his answer is absolutely not, no way in the world. God is so good, God's the very opposite, and the culprit here is sin and Satan. And how he uses what is so good, the law, to accomplish what is so bad, spiritual death. Okay. If there is any one section of Scripture that requires pausing and chewing and meditating and turning and twisting and cranking the wheels and all that kind of stuff, it's got to be this one. And then sometimes you come away after about the time you think you've got it all figured out, and then you come back tomorrow and read it again, and you think, wait a minute. All right. Now, I handed out last week kind of a rough outline of my exegesis of the remaining verses of the chapter. And I realized that what you've got that I handed out is not the same thing that Brother Harkrider says. He takes a different position. There's probably about three positions on this section of the text. One being that what Paul is describing from this point on is the situation of an alien sinner under any law, or whether he's talking about a Jew who was under the law of Moses, or whether he's talking about a Christian and how he wrestles with Satan's constant advances toward him and his plight on a daily basis. Harkrider, probably in his workbook, he expounds the latter probably as well as anybody. You know, so if you want to, you know, if you want to hear a pretty classic argument on that position, then you can read his. Mine's not the same. My persuasion is that what Paul is doing here now is, again, illustrating his answer to this question of, is the law sin? And if it's not, then how does Satan use the occasion of law to accomplish this bad result? And what goes on in the mind of the individual that's caught in this issue or this problem? As I say in the paper that I handed out, at this point, someone might logically wonder how someone living under something so good as God's spiritual law could possibly suffer something so bad as spiritual death. In the remaining verses of the chapter, Paul, uses himself as an example, explains how this is possible. So, you know, he has already affirmed dogmatically the law is good, but then here's something that results that is really bad, which is death. So how in the world does that happen? Now, I said perhaps, maybe, he's thinking about his days as a chief sinner. You know, he called himself that in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 15. You know, I'm the chief sinner. I am. In fact, he used the present tense there, which answers one of the arguments that everybody makes this argument that takes Harkrider's position. And that is, well, Paul's using the present tense here, so he has to be talking about himself in the here and the now, right now, today, problem that he's having with sin. No. No. What he's doing is showing how Satan, again, can use the law to accomplish the result that he wants. That is what Satan wants. And so Paul puts himself in that setting and describes it in the present tense. Now, when he said in 1 Timothy 1:15 that he was the chief of sinners, and that's not the word order there, but it is that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief. He uses the present tense there. And there's no way in the world that Paul would consider himself a habitual, prominent sinner in the world at that point in his life. He's talking about a previous time in his life. In fact, he tells you when he was talking about. He tells you back up in verse 13, I was before a blasphemer and a persecutor and injurious, but I obtained mercy. He was a chief sinner whenever he was persecuting Christians. That's his perception of when he was that chief or prominent or, you know, we might say star, in negative sense, sinner. And I'm fully persuaded that's exactly what he's doing here. He's talking about a time in his life whenever he was having a real struggle. And sent, because he wanted to do the law. He was dedicated to doing God's law. He knew the law was good. But what Satan was doing was using that good law to produce bad results. Now, he may have been thinking about when he was a persecutor. He did in chapter 1 of 1 Timothy, when he was persecuting Christians. He may have thought about the time whenever he was standing there holding the coats of the fellows that stoned Stephen. About when he then got authority from the priest to go to Jerusalem, the temple police to go to Damascus and to bring Christians back, and he was vehemently and actively involved in the persecution of Christians. Now, this would not require that's the only application of the principle that he's describing in this section, but I say, could it be? And you notice I've got a question mark there. My own persuasion is that's what he's talking about. Now, that this would fit. Now, it would fit irregardless of the particular events that Paul might have in mind, but what I did was I just walked through these verses and made some comments as if that's what Paul had in mind whenever he was making these statements. And like I say, it doesn't have to be when he persecuted Christians. It could have been at any other time, again, when he was living under law, wanting to do what was right, but Satan was using the law as an occasion for sin. So, let's start in verse 14. For we know that the law is spiritual. Yeah, it's good. You know, it came from God. It served God's purposes. But while Paul was trying to follow that law, which required, again, going back to that circumstance that we just described, the law required that false prophets and false teachers be put to death, Deuteronomy chapter 13. Then, Paul said, I am carnal, sold under sin. Now, he uses what's called the perfect tense here, the present perfect, which is the existing result of a past action, but it's used in the present sense. Again, it's the same thing as I'm a chief sinner. You know, I'm describing it as if it's happening right now, but it's what happened before. But the setting is, the description is present tense. Now, we got to remember that at that point in time, when Paul was persecuting Christians, he was fully persuaded that the law was the only law of God that he was amenable to. That he didn't for a minute even consider the possibility that the law had been done away with and now there was a new law. That wasn't even in the picture as far as he was concerned. So he is dedicated to doing the law of God as he understands it, which is the Mosaical law, which again required that false teachers, etc., be put to death. So what was happening is he considered himself an executioner of the law, but because of the way Satan had used the occasion, he in fact was a murderer. Remember, that's what he said in 1 Timothy 1. He was injuring people. He was blaspheming. So what was intended to be good was turning out bad. For what I am doing, that is, I'm executing justice on these false teachers, I do not understand. That is, I didn't realize they were innocent because the law had been abolished. For what I will to do, that as I would like to have let them go free, that I do not practice. No, he wasn't. He was persecuting them. He was arresting them. But what I hate, that is the persecution of these individuals, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, that is, I agree to their execution, I agree with the law that is good. In other words, it justifies my actions. Because he thought he was doing exactly what the law required, and so he was fully convinced that it was justifying his actions. But now, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. Again, Satan used Paul's ignorance and his strict passion for enforcing the law to Satan's benefit and not for the Lord's good. Now, just a little pause here. This statement that sin dwells in me, it's the personification of sin moving into a house and taking up residence there. There's not anything in this section of the text that even begins to imply that Paul is talking about an occasional occurrence. Based upon what we studied from chapter 6 and other passages of Scripture, I don't see how in the world a Christian trying to do God's will to the very best of his ability would ever say that sin has residence in my life, that it has taken, you know, it's controlling, it dwelling in me. And certainly Paul wouldn't have said anything like that. For I know that in me, that is my flesh, nothing good dwells. Again, because he's talking about a time in his life when Satan was using him to accomplish evil. Now, Satan was using his life, that is his fleshly life, to accomplish his agenda. That's Satan's agenda. And Paul had already, forcefully argued here in Romans chapter 6 against the idea that a Christian could continue practicing sin. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. So how in the world could he say that in chapter 6 and turn around in chapter 7 and say, there's nothing good in me? It appears to me to be a total contradiction to what he said in chapter 6. And again, a person who's talking about walking in newness of life with Christ, would he say there's no goodness in him at all? Period? For to will is present with me. That is my inclination, again, is to let these people go free. But how to perform what is good, I do not find. Yeah, he was again thoroughly convinced that the law demanded their death. And so again, he was caught in this dilemma. For the good that I will to do, that is, I'd like to let him go, I do not do, but the evil. By the way, there's a typo there on verse 19. That should be the evil, not he evil, but the evil that I will not to do, that I practice. In other words, I keep on persecuting Christians even though I felt like there was something that was just not right about what I was doing. Now, that's the only plausible explanation that I have for what is said in Acts 26:14. You remember in this account of Paul's third account of his conversion, we talk about when he was on the road to Damascus going to persecute those Christians, and the Lord appeared to him And he said in verse 14 of Acts 26, "And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice saying unto me in the Hebrew language, 'Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for thee to kick against the goad.'" Now, if you've ever been around farm animals, you know that if you want to kind of get their attention and get them going in a certain direction, you goad them. You prick them, okay, with a stick. Something was goading Paul. Even while he was on the road to Damascus going to persecute those Christians, something was really bothering him. I'm persuaded that that's what he's talking about in Romans chapter 7. And that's why the Lord said to him, "Yes, Paul, it's hard for you to do this." There was something inside of him that was saying, you know, the dots just don't connect. But he was so determined that he was going to keep the letter of the law that he kept on going in this course that was laid out to persecute these Christians. Now, verse 20. "If I do what I will not to do," again, executing the Christians, "it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me." Again, here's how Satan had taken occasion to use what was good to accomplish this evil result. And how what God had intended for good, again, the law, as Paul had said, the law is good, the law is righteous. Satan is using it to bring about evil results. And again, sin does not dwell in Christians. Even, you know, if Paul's talking about himself as a Christian, again, pray tell, how could he say in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 10, "You are witnesses, and God also, how holily and righteously and unblameably we behave ourselves toward you"? Why, that's the very opposite, it appears to me, of the idea of saying that sin dwells in me and no good things in me. "I find then a law," that is, in regard of the law. The American Standard has that in the marginal reading, and I think Whiteside also makes that, draws that conclusion. That is, again, in regard to the law, "that evil is present with me," again, because of how Satan was using the law. I know we're just about out of time. I want to get the completed thought, and then we'll come back next week and we can discuss these things, but I want to get this all out here. I find then a law, that is, with regard to the law, "that evil is present with me," again, because of how Satan was using the law, "the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man." And again, everything that God had enjoined upon Paul, he delighted to do that. Again, he was so excited to keep the law right down to the letter. But he said, "I see another law in my members." Again, when he was persecuting these Christians, "warring against the law of my mind," which, you know, wants to let them go free, "bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members." Here, sin is, he describes sin as having him as a slave. He's a slave to sin. That's what the idea of captivity is. He's enslaved to it. Well, in chapter 6, he had said, "No, you are a servant or a slave of the one, you know, that, who you obey." Well, if he's a slave of sin, that means he's obeying sin. That couldn't be said of a Christian. But the way he was being used by Satan, if the scenario that I've laid out is a proper application of the text, then yeah, that's what was happening. Okay. A Christian is supposed to present himself as alive from the dead, not dead in sin, and his instruments as instruments of members as instruments of righteousness, chapter 6, verse 13. Christians are not captives of the law of sin. We are free from sin's dominion. Again, we've got a whole new master, a whole new service that's described in chapter 6. We're servants of righteousness. Now, O wretched man that I am. Well, yeah, under the law, you can see why he would say that, what had been going on in the turmoil that he was experiencing. And again, I ask the question, would one who wrote so much about the joy of freedom in Christ describe a Christian's ongoing state as one of wretchedness? Look at the passages there that I cited. So his question is, well, who's going to deliver me out of this body of death? And remember, he talked about how the law is what caused him to die earlier in this paragraph. And the kids are coming in, so I'm going to have to stop right there. But process that, chew on it, roll it over, and we'll talk about it next week. Thank you. There's nothing new there. Did you get that last week?